weather, truth, and fun. We're iHub Radio, homegrown in the Coachella Valley. For a fresh take on the news with Anita Rufus. You won't know if you don't listen.
And thank you so much for listening. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. It is Saturday, June 6th. I'm here every Saturday, or almost every Saturday. We weren't here last week because there was some technical stuff going on here at the station, which I never understand, and thank God I'm not involved in it. It's difficult for me today because what's going on in our society right now is something that hits me very hard. This pandemic and the stay-at-home stuff has had me crying every day anyway. I cry when I see violence because it offends my sensibility. I cry when I see people coming together to make a difference because it is what I live for, the Pollyanna in me that honestly believes it can be better. One of the things I love about this country and the principles under which it was founded, not the reality, but the principles, is the idea that every generation moves us forward toward a more perfect union. That's a phrase that's in our founding documents. And I believe in that concept. And I believe it is up to the people to move toward a more perfect union, not our leaders, not our elected officials even, although the way our system was set up, it is designed for us to have people represent us both at a local, state, and federal level. Anyway, I want to start today with something odd. I'm always interested in those columns that say, today in history. And interestingly enough, today in history is all about war. Well, all right, it's not all about war, but it's the pieces I pulled out because I thought they were really impactful in realizing what is going on in our culture right now. And the fact that war has always been, all the way back to the Revolutionary War, war has always been one of the things that we track in terms of our history. Now, there are other things that we track in terms of our history, thank goodness. You know, today we're talking a lot about what happened in the 60s and Martin Luther King, and that takes you all the way back to the slave rebellions and the Jim Crow era that put down the idea that people might actually be equal. But the focus on war today interested me. In 1862, on this day, the Union Army claimed Memphis, Tennessee. And it was a big move forward in the battle for the Union Army to take over and move into the South and put down the rebellion that was the Civil War. So 1862 today, the Union Army claimed Memphis, Tennessee. 1918, which is significant because we are still under this pandemic, which, by the way, is getting worse in a lot of places and will because of the people who were out protesting without even a mask on, although I was impressed at how many had masks. But in 1918, which was the time of the huge pandemic that killed millions of people, 1918, on this day, June 6th, was also something called the Battle of Belleau Wood in World War I, a very significant battle and worth looking up if you want to have some sense of our history. The Battle of Belleau Wood was a significant battle, 1918. And then on this day in 1944, D-Day began in World War II. So today is important in three very significant wars that this country has been involved in. The Civil War, World War I, and World War II. Today is the 76th anniversary of the day that D-Day began. And for me, I find that significant. What we have been watching on TV all week, for the last more than a week, is the reactions to the horrendous death of George Floyd in, I just got that catch in my throat just picturing what happened in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I want to say something about Minneapolis because I've been very lucky in my life to have some events that stand out more than anything else. And if I ask you, for example, whatever pops into your head first in answer to this question is the right answer. What was the most perfect moment of your life? What was the most perfect day of your life? You know, it may have been when you were out, you caught the first real fish you had ever caught, and that sense of accomplishment. Or maybe it was the day you won an award or got your diploma in law school. Or what was the most perfect day of your life? Maybe it was the day you got married. And if I asked you, what's the most perfect week of your life? Most of us don't really have an answer to that. You know, maybe it was the first cruise we ever took, or maybe it was when you were involved in a war and that week was the week of some big battle and you won that battle and you remember that week clearly. But most of us can't really do what was the most perfect week of your life. I have one. And amazingly enough, it happened in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Unlike the president who called it Minneapolis, I actually know how to pronounce the name of that city. Long story short, I had met this guy through a blind date. He was a photographer doing a photo shoot in Minneapolis and asked me to come with him. And I did. And we were the guests of the city for a week while he was shooting everything for a photo spread about winter in Minneapolis for a famous national travel magazine. And I had the most perfect week of my life, including having grown up in Los Angeles, the first time I ever walked in falling snow. It was amazing. So I have real special feelings for Minneapolis. And it is distressing to me with that wonderful memory of a week. It's distressing to me to realize the inherent problems that have existed in Minneapolis way beyond my chance to watch people ice fish and walk through the incredible skyways that keep you out of the weather. I've talked many times about race on this program, and I will again say racism is the cancer at the core of our culture. We are born into it. Now, we're not born hating anyone. We learn that. But the culture teaches us a lot of that. For example, even before babies can talk, they're very aware of the sound of the tone of voice. When parents, or in kindergarten, when teachers are referring to someone who has a different skin color or some disability, when children hear a negative tone of voice that stereotypes someone as good or bad, preferable or unpreferable. They soak that in. That's part of our culture. And that's how they learn it. So people who say, well, but I've never discriminated against anyone. Well, have you ever stepped in when you heard someone else saying something negative? Have your children ever heard you intervene to say to somebody, you know, I don't appreciate hearing that. That's not right. People who, well, some of my best friends. Really? In other words, you separate out those people based on some characteristic over which they have no control. We learn racism and lack of respect for some people versus others when we come into this culture. And those who don't get that kind of respect for some immutable characteristic, they learn that they are seen as lesser than. Now, maybe it's something in our psyche, in our makeup as human beings, in our move down the evolutionary trail, where I've often said we're barely out of the slime at this point, but maybe those of us who are trying to make our way along that evolutionary road, maybe we need to feel better than somebody else. Maybe that is part of our culture. The whole goal, in fact, of identifying as an American is I can better myself. I can make myself into something better than what I was born into. And that's a tremendously encouraging thing in our culture. It makes people strive. It makes people want to get educated or do better or invent something new or make sure their children will have a chance to a better life than they had. Those are important qualities that are part of our culture. That striving to be better. But it also means that we see others as not as good. We have an inherent lack of respect for certain people. So when you hear the phrase Black Lives Matter, it makes a lot of sense this week because of what we saw happen to George Floyd. But the truth is, people who say, well, all lives matter. Well, of course all lives matter. But in our culture, some lives matter more than others. Attributing and evaluating another human being on the basis of an inherent characteristic is by definition, if it is related to the color of their skin, it is by definition racism. You're listening to The Anita Rufus Show. I am the Lovable Liberal, here live every Saturday from 10 to noon. And there's more coming. I've had a crying week.
Live from Palm Springs, she calls it as she sees it. Local talk that's moving the needle. Here's Anita Rufus on iHub Radio.
There was a woman I knew, 30 years ago. Older black woman, worked for a family that I knew. She took care of their house. She owned the kitchen. Nobody else was allowed in her kitchen. And whenever I was over there, we used to sit down and chat, and I was always interested to hear about how her grandsons were doing, and we got very friendly. And once I remember her saying to me, you know, all my life, I've either been known as auntie or girl. I never really had a name. And it broke my heart to hear her say that. Lovely woman. woman of intellect and sensitivity and capability. And the idea that this was the reality of her life, and I, of course, had, in those days, I had no way of understanding that. I had never met anybody who was able to say that to me. She had no name. She had no dignity as a human being. Like black men who have been called boy. It takes away your humanity and makes it clear that you are not on an equal par with whoever is using that as a way of addressing you. It's also the thing that I realized. For white people, it's way too easy to use the claim of crime as a way of avoiding looking at the reality based on a presumption of guilt. One of the key things in our justice system is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. But for far too many people in our culture, that has not been true. The presumption of guilt based on race has been so ingrained in us because we were born into this culture. And the truth of that is evident in so many ways, not just in the impunity with which that officer killed, those officers killed Floyd in Minneapolis. But just a couple weeks ago, before the pandemic shut down universities, the University of Maryland, for God's sake, there was a poster posted at the University of Maryland, and it said, "A notice to all white Americans. It is our civic duty to report any and all illegal aliens to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They are criminals." And then it ended with, "America is a white nation." As if all immigrants are not white? As if there's any justification in this country to ever say something like that? The systemic abuses that we have seen as a result of the death of Floyd and what are known as extrajudicial killings, meaning killings where there has been no adjudication in the justice system. In the past decade of people with names like Trayvon Martin and Philando Castile and Tamir Rice, what was he, 11 or 12, playing in a park by himself with a toy gun and killed by police? Sandra Bland, numerous other black Americans for which there was no legal resolution. The killing of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky breaks my heart. She was asleep in her own bedroom, for God's sake. Police were trying, they claimed, to serve a warrant, a no-knock warrant, battered her front door down in the middle of the night while she was asleep. Her boyfriend was there with her, thought somebody was breaking into the apartment, wanted to protect Breonna, and had a gun, and went out to confront whoever it was that was breaking in. He got shot, and she then was killed for no reason except that the cops made a mistake. And the truth is, nobody has yet gone to jail on that one. In fact, her 27th birthday, I think it was just this past week. Luckily, the police officers in Minneapolis as a result of the video are now facing charges, originally charged with third-degree murder, now second-degree murder, and the three other officers are facing charges and are now saying, well, that guy, you know, the one who was had his knee on the neck, he was our training officer. We had to go along with whatever he told us. Well, then your training sucks. Meanwhile, they are all now facing charges, $1 million bail. They cannot work in policing or security. They got to give up their guns and their gun permits. And yet we can't paint all police officers with that broad brush.
News, weather, and a couple of dozen loudmouths. This is iHub Radio. She calls it as she sees it. Now, here's Anita Rufus.
And again, I thank you so much for joining me. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. The phone number here, by the way, if you want to get in on the conversation, 760-544-8255. 544-8255. You can text us at 760-699-0202 or send an email with a question or comment to studio@ihubradio.com. I will say I did some digging because I really wanted to know who George Floyd was. And I don't think there's been enough talk this past 10 days, however long we've been going through this. I don't think there's been enough talk about who George Floyd really was. Now, if you watched the memorial service, and I believe there's another one today, and then his funeral will be in Houston, which is where he lived for most of his life. If you listened to some of the people who knew him, you got more of a sense of who he was. But if you didn't, I want to share this with you because I needed to find out for myself, who was this guy? In Houston, they knew him for how he had lived for decades as a mentor to a generation of young men and a person of peace doing ministries in the area where he lived. He moved to Minneapolis for a job opportunity through a Christian work program and because he did have family in Minneapolis. But he spent almost his entire life in the historically black Third Ward of Houston. He was known as Big Floyd, and he was regarded as a community leader and elder statesman, especially by a lot of the young people on the streets in that area. He spoke all the time about breaking the cycle of violence that he saw among young people in that black ward. And he used his influence to bring ministries into that area to do outreach. The pastor of a church called Resurrection Houston said George Floyd was a person of peace sent from the Lord that helped the gospel to go forward in a place that I had never lived in. And this is a pastor who was brought into that area of Houston by George Floyd to try and help the young men he saw there as a role model for what was possible to avoid letting the streets take over your life. That's who George Floyd was. A lot of people were saying after the initial autopsy, well, he had fentanyl in his system. I don't care. That didn't make him someone worthy of being killed. And I have to say that the idea of painting the police officers as the perfect monsters and him as the perfect victim, that isn't fair to any of them. But it is easier for us to believe that the violence can be explained by the moral failings of individuals rather than by the systemic racism in the system. Now, there are a lot of police organizations around the country that have done a lot to root that out. And just this week, Minneapolis announced that they are now banning any kind of chokehold or anything that might lead to this kind of death for the police. And I want to also say, look, the idea that there are some people who use these protests as an excuse for looting or violence, that doesn't solve any problem either. In fact, it only hardens the hearts of those who think there is no problem. And I want to credit that line to a guy named Dale Hansen, who does an online commentary in Dallas, Texas. He calls his commentary Unplugged. Dale Hansen, Unplugged. And if you have the time and the inkling or the inclination to do it, go look it up online, because his short piece that he did in this Unplugged online column that he does verbally is really powerful, coming from a white man in Texas. Talk about stereotypes. I lived there for 10 years. I know what that place can be like. But he said the looting and violence won't solve the problem. It only hardens the hearts of those who think there is no problem. By the way, for those of you who would like to arm yourselves to do a better job of educating your children, your grandchildren, even yourself, there is a really good resource if you go online to Anti-Racism Resource. It's an excellent site. Now, the thing I do want to talk about for a minute with regard to the violence and the looting. Yes, there are some people who will take advantage of that anytime somebody throws a brick through a window. But the Attorney General and the President coming out and claiming that all of the violence was being stoked by Antifa, which is described as an anti-fascist group of people. It is not really an organization. They have no central organizing. Nobody runs the organization. But there are a lot of young people in particular who claim they are Antifa, and they are the ones who went out to stand up against the Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville. That doesn't make them good people. But to automatically characterize the violence and looting as coming from the far left, which the president did. And every time I have heard the president speak about this or the attorney general speak about this, I have heard them say Antifa and other groups. They never mention the white supremacists who have been trying to use these protests as the instigation to start a race war. That's their goal. So there was a Twitter account that claimed to belong to a national Antifa group and that was pushing violent rhetoric that now it turns out has been linked to the white nationalist group known as Identity Europa. Twitter said the account violated their platform and they suspended the account because they found that it was a fake account that had been created by this white nationalist group. And this is a group, week ago Sunday, this newly created account on Twitter called @Antifa_US. They tweeted, "Tonight's the night, comrades," with a brown raised fist emoji. And then they went on to say, "Tonight we F the city and we move into the residential areas, the white hoods, and we take what's ours." That was a white supremacist group putting that message up to scare the crap out of people who live in the suburbs. I listened to right-wing radio this week and heard them talking about these far-left groups that are... Three men were arrested just a couple days ago in Nevada that have ties to a loose movement of right-wing extremists advocating the overthrow of the United States government. Yeah, you've got some far-left nuts who want to overthrow government. You also have some far-right groups who want to overthrow government. These three guys in Nevada were arrested on terrorism-related charges, and authorities said it was a conspiracy to spark violence during the recent protests about the Floyd death in Las Vegas. Three white men with U.S. military experience are now accused of conspiring to carry out a plan that began all the way back in April when we were having the protest to reopen businesses. Remember, oh, we have to reopen. We can't have everything shut down. Well, they began their plan back then, and they were going to tie it to the protests to reopen businesses. But they decided, hell, we might as well capitalize on the protests over the death of George Floyd. All three are white. All three have U.S. military experience. And they self-identify as part of something called the Boogaloo Movement. This is a growing collection of extremists, including far-right militia nuts, radical gun rights activists, white supremacists, and neo-Nazis. They use Boogaloo as a term to signify a coming civil war or fall of civilization. That's what it's meant by the term anarchist. But of course, everybody's trying to tie that to the peaceful protesters. Now, I am pleased to see that police all across the country took a public stand against the officers of Minneapolis and what they did. One police chief in Chattanooga, Tennessee, said there is no need to put a knee on someone's neck for 9 minutes. There is a need to do something. If you wear a badge and you don't have an issue with this, turn your badge in. And there are police all over the country who are taking a similar stand about what happened. And part of the reason for that is a lot of these police departments across the country have gone through retraining, have tried to weed out the bad apples. Why is it so hard to convict police? In 1967, the year when that Miami police chief coined that phrase, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, which the president used and then tried to justify and said he didn't know where it had come from. The Supreme Court articulated the notion of what is called qualified immunity regarding police violence against a group of civil rights demonstrators in Michigan. This was back in 67. And the court held that police officers should not face legal liability for enforcing the law in good faith and with probable cause. That any violation of someone's rights has to be clearly established, meaning a previous court case has to have found that that same behavior was not legal. And of course, if everybody is claiming qualified immunity, there is no case you can cite. That needs to get fixed. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, and you're listening to iHub Radio.
Because you only think you know the truth. Striking blows against the corporate talk radio monolith in the Coachella Valley. iHub Radio. Participation encouraged, but not required. Here's Anita Rufus.
So I want to tell you a little bit more about this qualified immunity thing, which is what has gotten most police officers off, even when what they have done has been egregious. Since 2005, courts have shown an increasing tendency to grant immunity, even in excessive force cases. And what was originally intended to prevent frivolous lawsuits against police or even agents of the government has become a highly effective shield in thousands of lawsuits seeking to hold cops accountable. Now, by the way, qualified immunity pertains only to civil lawsuits. So if a cop beats you up or invades your home and, you know, causes whatever distress using excessive force during a traffic stop, to try and do anything through the criminal courts is almost impossible. But even if you sue them in a civil suit, qualified immunity, which was defined by the Supreme Court during the period of the civil rights demonstrations, that officers should not face legal liability for enforcing the law in good faith with probable cause, and that is how police officers have been able to avoid any kind of real penalty. So let me show you what qualified immunity can mean in a case that ties directly to what happened with George Floyd. There is a Minneapolis police officer who in 2014 was accused of brutalizing a black man without probable cause, leaving the man traumatized and with a broken tooth. 3 years later, this officer, who had been sued, settled the lawsuit out of court for $25,000 to the black man, which the city of Minneapolis paid in full because the officer was working for the city. That officer's name was, I'm going to not pronounce it well, but it was Tu Tao. And last Monday, Tao stood on that Minneapolis street while Derek Chauvin put his weight into George Floyd's neck and watched as George Floyd was killed. Tao is now being charged as an accessory for not having stopped it. But this is what happens when there is no real legal penalty for excessive use of force, let alone killing somebody. Well, now, at least, hopefully, there will be a reckoning. The Democrats have introduced in the House of Representatives something called the George Floyd Law Enforcement Trust and Integrity Act, calling for new national policing standards and accreditations. And it would require every state, local, and federal law enforcement agency to provide data to the Department of Justice on the use of deadly force, both by and against police officers. It would also make funding grants available to police agencies to study and create new recruitment, hiring, and oversight programs. Look, good police officers don't want this kind of thing, putting people in a position to not trust the police. There was an amazing story I read about an 11-year-old kid who was being raised in a black neighborhood, being raised by good parents, going to school, and he was asked if he saw something like what happened to George Floyd, or if he felt that he was in some kind of danger or his family was in some kind of danger, 11 years old, would he call 911? And he paused for a minute and he said, I don't think so. They usually bring more trouble. Well, if this is the reality that young people are growing up with, regardless of where they live, with the assumption that because their skin is not white, therefore they are at risk, that is something we need to fix. And that is what is meant by intransigent or intrinsic racism in the system. Sure, we want police to stop crime. Sure, we want our neighborhoods to be safe. But if you want to understand the concept of white privilege, it is the inherent reality that when I, as a white woman, sent my son, as a white young man, out to the store to pick something up for me, I didn't caution him to be concerned if he saw police, because he might end up dead. But the black women I know who have sons, including my stepdaughter who has my black grandsons, she can't send her kid out to the store to pick something up without at least cautioning him. Now, we've all heard about this case about Amy Cooper, the white investment executive who was walking a dog in Central Park in New York. And the sign right there said, your dog must be on a leash, but hers wasn't. And there was a young man who was a bird watcher who was in that same area. And by the way, I just want to acknowledge that when we hear the phrase black bird watcher, all of us do like some kind of a weird juxtaposition in our heads, because that is so far from any stereotype we have ever heard. But he's a science editor, happens to like watching birds in Central Park, and politely asked her to leash her dog, and he had his phone camera on. She had a leash in her hand. She pulls the dog up by its collar, literally choking him. And she starts approaching the black bird watcher, Christian Cooper. And Cooper says, please don't come close to me. And she says, I'm going to call the police and tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life. And that's what she does. And he was being polite and low-key. He did not approach her. And she did call the police, and that's what she told them. Because we know, in our culture, if you tell the police that a black man is threatening you and you're a white woman, they're going to show up and you are going to prevail. That is the incipient racism. And that's what we've got to root out. And we can only do that if we root it out of our own consciousness first.